All right, everybody. Thank you for tuning in again. This is Jim. My name is Jesse. Hello, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Jesse. Good to see you. Welcome for having me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. This is a bit of a different setup for me. As I said, this is a hotel room setup while I'm traveling with family. But you got to keep it going, right? So a few hiccups here and there, but thank you. We made it. We're going to talk about control boards today, something okay. that I understand very little about. We also met in Vegas, I believe, for the very first time, and you were gracious enough to jump on here. Hash rate index is having a bit of an issue, so I'm not going to share screen as per usual now. We are recording at block height 905.826, and then current fees is like 3 sats per V-byte, so we're getting a bit more elevated here. I think also because of the recent sharp increase in price. I think, let me check, we are now, while we're recording, at 118,000. So that hash price likes that, right? It gets pulled up short time and everybody pulls out their M30s. You just said you're not really looking at hash price every day. Why not? And is hash price important to your business in any case?
Absolutely it is. For us here at Epic, we focus on I'll call it horizons that are a little further out in time. And for sure, we have team members at Epic who would watch that very carefully. But for myself, I'm kind of, as a steward, looking at investors, looking at what our customers are looking for, a little longer term horizon. So for myself specifically, I don't. And if I get caught up into those nitty gritty details, the gears of the engine, no one else is looking at steering the car. And so in that respect, I answered that question that I don't look at it daily. That's just kind of how we operate here at Epic is we're a small team, but we have people looking at different aspects, and I'm focused obviously on the bigger picture, longer term horizon.
Yeah, fair enough. Maybe before we get too deep into it, Jim, give people a bit of a focus on your person and highlight Epic a bit more and where you add value to the market.
Okay. So I'm Jim Cito, the CEO of Epic Blockchain. I've had this role for about 4 years now. Epic, I would describe, is a hardware semiconductor company. So we entered this marketplace really coming from the area of silicon foundry GPU design. And that's really our skill set that we bring into this fast-growing market. And that's who we are. For the last half dozen years, we've been developing products either at the full-scale mining level or at the individual subcomponent level, be it things like control boards or system solutions, be it firmware optimization, helping our clients work the stack from inception of hardware right through to mining and scale. So it's a great place to be because we're growing very quickly, and the company is in a market that I think is expanding. And those are the kinds of things that I look for in my role. Is I tend to help companies that have tremendous potential, and there's a great fit for what they do. And my role today at Epic is as the CEO is to help guide them, grow them, and scale. And I really enjoy doing that. And for me, it's tremendous satisfaction to see other people take on and grow and develop and ride the tiger, as sometimes they say.
Why mining, Jim? Why did you decide to be in the mining industry?
Well, truth be told, when I came out of retirement, I didn't know anything about crypto, blockchain, or mining. And when I was introduced to this team here at Epic, it very quickly dawned on me that is something that I knew nothing about, that I wanted to learn, that I knew some of my domain expertise could maybe help, which is on the hardware design side. So kind of a lifetime of learning, I said, wow, I think I want to understand more about that. So, you know, you kind of fast forward to now, it's a spot where I see that the skill set that the team has, the market that it's playing in is growing. With the additional people that we've brought on, we can also now scale and execute. So those are the things that, you know, for a startup are in important ingredients. And, you know, I went into mining kind of by accident because I just thought I could help this team. And sure enough, it's worked out well. And the players in the supply chain also see that the ability to execute really matters. And it's not more than just a good idea. And you know, that's how I find myself at Epic and at this company and frankly in mining. And it's great.
And before, again, we met each other and I knew Epic for the control boards. That's how I knew the brand. You also said you do firmware optimizations. Is there anything else that you guys have in your portfolio?
Well, we actually build miners. It's in the public domain. Some of the programs that we worked on, some of them are still not because they're behind the curtains. But the one that I could speak to is I think 4 years ago, 3 years ago, Intel announced they had their block scale SHA-256 chip. And Epic is actually to this day the one that actually has built a system from the ground up using that chip and delivered it to a pubco.
All right.
In scale. And people who are maybe really into the hardware space know that, and that's what we do. We've partnered with the different large mining hardware providers out there and actually developed a firmware for it. That actually came as a response or a customer request was the firmware that you're developing for the Intel platform addresses all of their needs. Can you maybe do that also for the platform of a Bitmain as an example, or of a micro BT? And our reaction initially was, but that's not the hardware we developed on. But the feedback from our clients was, yeah, but you really understand what we want. You really can understand the hardware because that's where you come from. Optimizing on top of that seems like a very good fit. And our resilience and our adaptability said the conclusion was, yeah, maybe we should do that. And we developed the control boards around, for example, the Bitmain platform. And it worked out really well for us because it actually got the attention of a lot of the larger constituents who are actually buying their hardware.
And can you go into detail as to what those demands are from the market? Like, where is the gap where people say, you know, what doesn't work well enough?
So one of the challenges of scale is can your firmware integrate with maybe some of their, I'll call it fleet management optimization investments that they've done? So who can make changes at the level below it to control all of the hardware? So we can do that. One of the challenges is also with the ability to control extreme operating conditions and do it dynamically. I think in Texas, it's very common about having to shut down your machines very quickly if the price of electricity spikes up because it's just an open market. How do you respond to that very quickly and then recover very quickly? So the heat wave, I think, is going on right now in that part of the world. And in the afternoons, it can get really, really hot. So what do you do to maybe preserve your hardware and have it running at a different optimization point? So the ability to dynamically respond to an environment is something that our customers are noticing that we could do with the work that we did with the Intel platform and frankly some of the other stuff we're doing.
Okay, and so maybe just to zoom out a little bit, the control board, explain on the mining or on the ASIC today where it sits and what it does specifically, sure. Maybe, and then let's try and understand why you need a control board replacements to have those tweaks instead of just doing everything on a software level.
Well, it's kind of interesting. We can do both. We can actually, our firmware and software can actually run natively on an existing hardware. We've had clients ask us to port that way because they don't want to go and invest the labor of changing out hardware. So again, the nature of our company is we'll listen to what our customers want, so we do that. But with respect to a control board, think of it really as the nervous system that controls and sits right in the middle between the wider fleet that's above it, which is, you know, the mining infrastructure, and then the actual hardware below it on an individual space. So being in that middle spot, you're able to control the hardware above you, also respond to the feedback above you. So I call it a nervous system. Some people call it the brains, but that is the substantial, significant kind of value add or value proposition that we do. A lot of the hardware providers that might be out there that are quite far away from the end customer will develop a basic set of software, believing that's what the customer wants and needs. But oftentimes it's just not enough. And we come in there and we can either replace the control board with our system solution, or we can actually improve on what they already have.
This episode is sponsored by Hashbranch, the easiest way to mine Bitcoin in the US. Sourcing hardware and rack space usually is a mess. Bad deal structures, misaligned incentives, and no visibility after deployment. I have placed tens of thousands of ASICs in partnership with Hashbranch. What I like most is that they cut through the noise. Fair pricing, aligned terms, and access to hosting that actually works. Use code HASHRATEUP100, visit hashbranch.com today to get $100 off of each miner that you order.
Okay, and are there changes, Jim, where you need a control board replacement and can't do everything on the software level? What's the main reason people buy a new control board and invest in more hardware than, again, just asking you to do everything on the software?
There's a couple of aspects there. It's actually a very good question on why people might want their own hardware versus just a pure software solution. People may want their own hardware because they feel it's more in their control because it's more customizable. It's the provider. It could maybe potentially offer more security. And also, certainly during the COVID period, it was also a scalability issue too, is with supply chain issues, they feel if they have that in their grasp or in an engagement where they have a better control, it's much better. And then obviously, if it's a pure software solution, it's less labor intensive to make a swap out. So those are the kinds of trade offs.
Okay, I know. So the first time I heard about your control boards was from Gridless, I think.
Oh yes, they're a great partner that works with us in your part of the world, and we really like what Eric and team are doing in Africa, and that's also some of the thinking when I came into the space of learning and I'll say drinking the Kool-Aid about what a decentralized ecosystem could do is actually helping, for example, geographies like South Africa, where you know, there's kind of a mismatch of lack of power, but the need for it, and how do you break that chicken and egg? And when I learned about what Gridless was doing, I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. They're knocking down two or three problems all at once, and kudos to them.
Yeah, it's those kind of setups where, and I'm coming across similar ones in South Africa now. In Kenya, South Africa, I mean, it's all the same principle, right? You have a power source and then you have stranded power and you want to sort of analyze how much power is available and sort of ride that curve to eke out every kilowatt hour that you can. And the stock firmware on older MicroBT models might be very limited. How easy is it to just swap and replace the control board? Is it just a easy thing to do, or explain it a bit more?
I've done it myself, actually. I just go in there, just kind of walk a mile in the shoes of our techs and our customers. It's actually very simple, and it's actually no different than changing a power supply or doing the normal PM of servicing the fans. And that's frankly the optimal time to do it is when the rigs are off. You asked an earlier question about what is another use case. The gridless use case is a perfect example. Their sites are remote, their sites are far away. Serviceability becomes an issue. As an example, with a stock firmware, if one hashboard goes down, the whole system might shut down, but yet the other two hashboards are still working. But because the firmware is potentially, the stock firmware is potentially more limited, you lose the whole rig. In our firmware, we can actually offer where if one hashboard goes down, that's unfortunate, someone will have to go there, but he can't go there in 24 hours. He might go there in 2 weeks or in a month when they do their cycle. But our firmware allows them to continue to operate with the other hashboards that are working in the system. And that's kind of a very micro optimization. You might argue in a large pubco in Texas, it doesn't matter. But in a use case like a remote site, it really is significant. So those are some of the examples of the optimization that we can do. And to your question, is it hard to do? I don't think so. But our mindset at Epic of developing hardware, whether it's the control board, whether it's the hash board, whether it's the full system, is we'll listen to what the customer wants. And that for me actually is where you build the trust and you build the engagement. And then wherever the market will take you, we'll adapt to it.
How easy is that though? Because, if you just go into every direction that the customer pulls you, how do you prioritize what you want to build first?
Is being customer centric is important, but obviously if you have 1,000 ideas coming at you, how do you pick the top 10? And, in that respect, customers' understanding of the market and our interpretation of their wants and needs obviously factors in. At the end of the day, it's a business decision as well, right? Our profile actually is I would say probably a little more on the low side of people knowing who we are, because we actually work with maybe a dozen companies at a deeper level versus a broader, hundreds of companies with a smaller footprint. And our philosophy has probably been, and our traction and success has been more with deeper engagements that way. And in that situation, those deep engagements really speaks to more of a strategic, longer term horizon kind of thing. And those companies obviously have a strong motivation to pick the right areas to invest in because it's their success. So that's kind of how we factor in the layering of the decisions.
Have you considered building your own fleet management tool?
We have, and we've been asked to do that. And for now, we're not going to go do that. Honestly, there's just so many other opportunities at the hardware level that people are asking us to go work on. I mentioned earlier about scalability, modularity is an important aspect. Thermodynamics is an important aspect. And we feel we could actually help tremendously in that space with our customers.
What do you mean by modularity? How do you guys help miners become more modular?
Well, if you look at the current standard footprint, it's basically use as long as you can and then kind of throw away and buy the next one. And but as you go from one generation to the next, a lot of the stuff maybe doesn't have to be thrown away. And how do you actually extend the life of your capital investment? And so we've had clients asking us to develop a system that where maybe you could replace the different hash boards, or maybe you can actually develop a power supply that could last multiple generations. So the industry in itself is maturing from a very fast pace, use it. And then when it wears out, throw it away, and something else better will come along, to maybe more of, we're making a huge capital investment here. Instead of 2 years or 3 years, can it last 5 years? And if you're really thinking out of the box, if I redesign my entire mining infrastructure to be, instead of supporting a standard 4 kilowatt kind of footprint, can it support 10, 20 kilowatt kind of subsystem? And then what do you do?
That would require Bitmain to sell just hashboards. Do you see that coming in the future?
Well, Bitmain themselves, I have a different view on Bitmain, by the way. I think very highly of them, and I think they're very capable. If people think that they're a competitor, I like to think of them as a partner that we can work with. They are growing, they are maturing. We work very closely with them, and they listen and they respond. And there it comes back to an investment in time, an investment in trust. And that was actually something that people asked us, do you really want to work and develop firmware on the Bitmain platform? Aren't they the competitor? And my view was, no, I don't think they're my competitor. I think if anything, if I can help them succeed, I know I will succeed. And that's kind of our view. Will they ultimately sell hash boards? Will they go in a different direction? I would say Bitmain's a very, very agile company, as much as they're large and far away. And all I can say is watch that space.
Yeah, no, I'm very acutely aware because of where I am and because of what my company tries to do, bringing more hash rate to Africa. I'm very aware of all the used units that are standing around looking to be sold. And I think never before have we had so many, miners sitting around on pallets waiting to be shipped somewhere because the power where they are is just too expensive, right? Okay. But the chassis, the PSUs, the control boards even, all of those are not broken. They could still work. And it's very obvious with the whole BitX development, right? If you're a BitX manufacturer, and you basically have to solder off the chips from the hashboards, now you're left with all of these parts, and what do you do with them? They're still fine. You can still use them, but then who's going to use so many spare parts as well, right? So what you say is really interesting, where you say, okay, no, look, we're going to invest multiple millions into new ASIC hardware, and we don't just want to turn over all of the machines 4 years later. We want to be able to swap and replace hashboards for more efficient ones very effectively, and sort of hot swap the miner effectively, right? Jim, you mentioned thermodynamics just before as well. How do thermodynamics tie into what you're doing?
At the end of the day, and if you look at the silicon technology, you can do just so much functionality in a small space now. As they say, the chips are getting more dense, smaller, and you can just pack more in it. With that means more heat is being produced. So at the end of the day, performance at a mining level is all about removal of heat. At the end of the day, it's how do you actually pull the heat out of the hardware that's working so hard. And that's really a heat exchange thermodynamic problem. People have solved it either by more airflow, obviously, There was the huge wave with immersion. Now the direct chip cooling, as they call it, which is really a hydro-like solution, is moving forward. So the ability to exploit what's available on the silicon technology is driving the fact that more heat is being produced. And then how do you get rid of it? If you get rid of more heat, then the transistors themselves on the silicon actually can be operating even more efficiently. And that's actually, at the end of the day, the crux of the problem is energy efficiency at the transistor level. So the thermodynamics piece is I don't know how else, more simplified to say, is you just got to get the heat out. And how do you do that? And that's what we're helping our customers do.
So how do you compare air cooling, hydro immersion then? What's your favorite out of those solutions when it comes to heat removal? And do you think that what are your thoughts on the what's it called? Dual cycle, the two-pick idea of two-phase immersion?
So I'll try to talk to each of those points in order. Air-cooled obviously is the most straightforward and the installed infrastructure that is out there. So a lot of people still want to push for that. And it's the lowest cost of capital. So I see the advantage of that. The challenge with that, though, then is you move the problem back into the more requirement of using newer technologies at the foundries like TSMC. So the problem in the air cooled is it's lower cost of capital to operate, but then you move the problem to the chip space. And after a while, there's a crossover there where maybe it's not economical. Earlier, I mentioned that we were working with Intel on the block scale SHA-256 chip. We actually went and prototyped and built a hydro solution with their chip, a water block, as it's really called a water block. People, the marketing speak is direct cooling. At the end of the day, it's a water block. It's what's been used in the GPUs for decades and also in the CPU space, which is where we come from, which we know how to do. We demonstrated that really early on, actually about, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago. And Intel was actually surprised at our ability to take that their complex design and even make it even more heat efficient. And we actually ran the clocks up all the way up to 1.3, 1.5 gigahertz just to demonstrate. So you asked me the question, what do I like? I'm actually a fan of the air cool because I know that the install base is there and is needed, but I also really like the hydro that's coming along. The immersion is interesting, but it's a little on the messy side if you ask me. There's safety concerns. You asked about the two-phase immersion technology. I've seen it in the labs, man, if that system is not sealed properly, some gas is going to get out, and then when it's boiling, you know, I think people have to be very careful on the safety side of it. And obviously, it's not going to be something you can just drop into any remote site. So the use case for it might be limited.
Are there limits, do you think, so what is the limitation when it comes to air cooling and getting ever more heat out of these chips? The fans can only spin so fast, right? What do you think is the limitation? And where do you see sort of the broader market moving in 5 years? What's going to be sort of the share of cooling technologies?
So that's interesting. Is the optimization point for large air-cooled infrastructure may not be at the rig level, but at the power supply level and the power distribution that goes into it. There's a lot of efficiency that is lost when the power goes into the building and then ultimately gets dropped or transformed to what's needed for the miners. So can there be an optimization where the rigs themselves operate with a higher voltage and you get efficiencies that way? Because at the end of the day, if it's kilovolts going into your transformers, and believe it or not, a transistor at 3 nanometer is operating at 0.3 volts. That whole transition from that super high voltage to the low voltage is where, you know, heat is lost, efficiency is lost. How do you optimize that? So, you know, in an air-cooled system, is it just a matter of pushing more air through, and what is the limit? I think the optimization point at the infrastructure level in those applications might actually be in the power delivery level.
Okay, so that's where the lowest hanging fruit is.
That's a good way to say it, yeah. Again, we get all the feedback from our clients who are in that space. And to your point, you know, do I just put bigger fans? Gosh, you know, there's only a limit to that, right?
Yeah. But yeah, no, absolutely. And it's at the end of the day, it's all about efficiency and how much power goes in and how much hash comes out.
Yes.
Which is why I think frequently you see miners move towards MicroBT more, or trend towards MicroBT more when it's about remote locations, because those machines just seem to have a longer lifespan than Bitmain machines do, for whatever reason. And so that's what I try to tell my clients and customers frequently. Is like, it doesn't matter what the efficiency is on paper. Once the machine has run for 2 years, you know, you want to know what the efficiency is then. And if your machine needs to be touched 10 times over that lifespan, then it's not likely that it's more efficient than a machine that only had to be taken off the rack 2 times, right? if you, just to go back to the control board discussion, Jim, if I took a miner today, any random model, let's say I have an S21 Pro hosted, and now I buy one of your control boards and connect it, what is going to be sort of the obvious effects of that? Is the miner going to immediately become more efficient? Is the interface just a lot more nice that gives me a lot more data? What are the main benefits for anyone to use one of your control boards on their machines?
HashRedUp is sponsored by solomining.de, the place to buy open source home and solo mining devices like the BitX. With about 20 watts of usage, these solo mining devices are perfect to play the lottery from home or from the office. Get 5% off with the code HashRedUp. Thanks to the legends at solomining.de for sponsoring the content.
Actually, it's not even just the control board. It's using the firmware. It's at the end of the day, it's flexibility. The ability to tune, the ability to respond. There is obviously an advantage of set it and forget it kind of configuring a miner. But unfortunately, you can set it and try to forget it, but the environment around you will keep changing. And unless you can control the weather, unless you control the sunlight and the heat that goes into a container or a building, that is a reality of inputs that need to be factored in. So our firmware and our control board gives that ability to control. And at the end of the day, that's what the customer really wants. There may be a set of use cases where people just don't want to touch it after they've programmed it. But then they soon realize that, I'll use the example of the MicroBT. They set it and forget it. But, you know, in that stock configuration, if one hashboard goes down, the whole machine goes down. But in the use case of what we can provide is, if unfortunately one does go down, it's not frequent, but if it does, at least the other two can operate. So that gives the, in this case, gridless the control. In the case of a miner in Texas where they have to react to the pricing of power or the heat variance, they want that control. So it's really what we provide. is that layer of optimization that people might leave on the table. In the early days, it didn't matter, but as the industry matures, every percent, every nuance like that starts to creep into the equation.
And is it
about reliability? I think that's another issue too. Is the total cost of ownership? I think people call it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And Jim, is Epic, when was the last time Epic raised funds, or have you ever raised funds to develop something new? Is that coming again?
I hinted earlier, so where am I spending my time? It's not looking at hash prices. It's actually talking to investors and talking to clients who see our vision and our journey and our resilience. And so we've actually only ever done a seed round. As they call it, we are looking at possibly an A round, and we tend to cater a lot more to, I'll call it, investors who are more like builders. They understand there's a longer term horizon. They might understand that what we do is as the cliche say, it's a journey. It's not a spike in time. And so we're in that phase right now, and it's actually quite exciting when we share our story of what we've done, how we've actually survived in the last 5 years, because frankly a lot of startups in our space have come and gone. So we are in that process of looking at how to raise capital to scale. And
would you consider doing that to develop more and faster, or is there any are you building miners again? Like where do you see the allocation happening?
Okay, yeah. So the use of capital is I think what you're
yes
you're asking about. So we're only a team of 22 people. People are really surprised when they hear that our team is so small and that we can do what we do. But there is a factor of scaling, which is hiring more talent. We are very engineering and operation centric. I like to tell people we're a little bit like the Palantir story. I think if you talk to Alex Karp or you listen to some of his interviews, he'll say that for the first 10 years of their journey, they had no sales and marketing. They didn't need it. Their sales and marketing was actually the product, their reputation, their engineering, and their support. And that's what sold itself. But as you get to a certain size, it does start to make sense. So use of capital is do we have, myself and Earl are the chief sales officers for the company, even though I'm the CEO and he's the CTO. But does it make sense at a certain point to actually invest in the marketing, invest in the I'll call it traditional sales functionality? For us, we believe our product and our engagement and our support of our customers is our recipe for sales, but we understand that's needed in the future.
And you guys are mainly focused on the American market. Is that a valid statement? I mean, you talked about Bitmain and of course they're mining as well. You see like differences in how you engage customers and what they want depending on where they from?
To answer your question, we are predominantly catering to the deep customers that are in North America. Yeah. We are actually hopeful that engagements maybe in Africa could take off beyond what we might be doing with the Gridless team. In the Middle East, there, as much as they're a really well-capitalized geography, I think their requirements are a little different. And they're probably a little more focused on the, it's actually, we've spoken for almost an hour and I haven't even mentioned the word AI. That part of the world right now tends to be more concentrated on where to invest in tech companies that in the AI space. So we watch the geographies very carefully on where we can grow and scale quickly. In Asia, it's all about the supply chain, and we are very well ingrained already into the foundry world and the system build world.
Well, yeah, okay. I mean, do you have a take on on where sort of the next big mining hub is going to erupt? Because a lot of the focus has been on America after China. And I mean, China is still the second largest mining nation in the world. Nobody really knows how much there is, but there is a lot. And
I would love to see it in, believe it or not, in East Africa, because it's a chicken and egg. Is I think the utility providers will not build out the transmission lines to a spot if there's no use case, but the people that are there will not invest in appliances and or take up the load if it's not readily available. So how do you break that chicken and egg? And could a solution like Bitcoin mining in that space be the perfect bridge for both sides? And I think it's starting to, and I would love to see that happen.
Ethiopia is a good example. I'm just very aware of the regulatory volatility. Yeah. Because, you know, you look at America, okay, cool. Now you have to got the tariffs and everybody seems to not have figured out any alternative. LATAM is kind of difficult because of all the import tariffs, and Paraguay wasn't really a good lead. I see Mexico growing. I want more hash rate in Africa, but then, you know, it is very regulatory unstable and there's a lot of greed. And I think like in Ethiopia, the EEP has made $220 million just from selling power that was otherwise stranded and wasted as substations. So that could really be a model. And if they keep that up and manage the curtailment and push miners to remote sites where substations have stranded power, that can be really can have a kickoff effect to many other nations who can figure out, hey, you know, we can, in a self-sovereign way, use this technology and use this industry and attract business to make money independently of anyone. But then you also have, you know, I think it was Pakistan where the IMF just mentioned, listen, guys, if you want loans from us, you cannot use your stranded power for mining. And just like, you know, where is it going to go? There's so many machines out there.
I think you're touching on, Jesse, geopolitics is really kind of top of mind in terms of trying to make those kinds of long-term strategic business decisions. And sometimes I say change is the only constant. So to the degree that, you know, where we are at Epic, we're a little bit insulated from that because, you know, we developed the hardware and it can go anywhere, but we're sensitive to that. You know, for us right now, we've been very, very adaptable and resilient, and by offering products that can operate in a wide range, I think it's great. You know, you mentioned about where to expand, or what I think is a good example of success is I think what they're doing in Bhutan, where a combination of horizon, people are thinking long term and understand the benefits of it, and to the degree I'll call it patient capital, you know, those are, I think, ultimately I'll call it foundational for success. If it's like whatever government tends to be in for that cycle, 3-year, 4-year, 5 cycle, and it could change again, it makes it very hard to do any kind of planning and long-term kind of strategic investments. And
we should have another episode maybe, Jim, on focusing more on that stuff.
I'm not an expert on that by any means, Jesse, but I watched that very carefully.
There's a lot of people out there, Jim, who put microphones in front of their faces who are not experts at anything. So
I'm very seldom in front of a microphone. So
I know you said, and that's why I appreciate your time even more. Do you want to give people a handoff, Jim, and just highlight whatever you want and give people a point as to where they can learn more?
We have a website, epicblockchain.io, but I think, you know, we're a lot of steak, not a whole lot of sizzle, in a sense that we don't have a big marketing presence, but we really believe that our execution, our reputation, and our commitment to investing in this space is going to carry us through the day. And certainly at firsthand, now I'm seeing that with this round of investing that I'm looking to secure is people with a long-term vision, people who are understand hardware, could see the benefits of what maybe a company like Epic can do. And, you know, you taking a chance and meeting with me in Vegas saying, I'd love to learn more about Epic, you know, I would be a fool to say no. And it's a great chance to share our story. So I appreciate it.
I got what I wanted, Jim. I hope you did as well. thank you again so much for your time. Guys, if you want to learn more, follow Jim. The website and everything is going to be below. Epic Hashboards. If you're a miner, check it out. See what it can do for you. And yeah, until next time.